Case number 15-1102. Kimberly Stewart et al. Petitioners versus National Labor Relations Board. Mr. Talman for the petitioners, Mr. Side for the respondent, and Ms. Martin for the intervener.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, I'm Glenn Taubman for the petitioners. During a hiatus between collective bargaining agreements, the seven petitioners and over 700 other grocery workers exercised their Section 7 rights to refrain from supporting a union by revoking their dues deduction authorizations, something that Section 302C4 allows every employee to do, quote, beyond the termination of the applicable collective bargaining agreement, unquote. But the dues collections continued despite these lawful revocations. Section 7 and Section 8 of the National Labor Relations Act protect employees' paramount right to voluntary unionism, their right to refrain from being forced to pay dues when they are under no legal obligation to do so. And Section 302C4 works in tandem with Section 7 and 8 to ensure that money is not seized from employees' salaries without their consent.
Can I ask you what I just want to make sure I understand your position as to what Section 302C4 means? Are you saying that any checkoff authorization that has any restriction on being able to opt out, so to speak, beyond 1 year violates the statute?
If it doesn't follow the express terms of Section 302, it violates that statute, yes. So Section 302, as Atlanta Printing Specialties in the Fifth Circuit and Anheuser-Busch in the Fourth Circuit both said, Section 302C4 provides for two distinct revocation periods. One, there has to be an annual opportunity to revoke, which is generally keyed to the signing date. And then, when there is a hiatus in a contract, there is a distinct revocation period that is, quote, beyond the termination of the applicable collective bargaining.
What language in 302C4 says it's got to be annual?
That goes to the first part of 302, which really isn't actually an issue in this case, and that's the part that says a written assignment which shall not be irrevocable for a period of more than 1 year. That's the first part. That's not truly at issue in this case. This case deals with or beyond the termination.
But it says whichever occurs sooner. So let's suppose there's a 3 year collective bargaining agreement. And on day one of that collective bargaining agreement, an employee signs an authorization for the checkoff. So are you saying that anything that restricts his ability to revoke that checkoff more than 1 year later violates 302C4?
Yes, the first part of it. Yes, I would say that. Alternatively, if I can read.
But what do you mean it violates the first part of it? It's all one provision.
Yes, but the courts have said there are two distinct revocation periods. And again, the issue here.
But you haven't been taking the position, as far as I can tell in your briefs, that even with respect to the first part of it, that after 1 year, there's a infinite revocability.
No.
You haven't been taking that position.
No, I'm not taking that position.
You've been taking the position that the first part means that it's a maximum period of 1 year, so that it can be a one-year period of irrevocability that's repeated.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, okay.
And it is repeated. If you look at Atlanta Printing Specialties, they talk about how when an employee lets that one-year period go by and doesn't revoke, then it, in effect, it's like he's signing a new check off again. So with regard to the first portion of the statute, yes, it annually renews. It can be irrevocable. What this whole case is about is that here the contract did terminate. It had a term of October 2003.
So here's part of what I'm not following about this case. It comes to us, it seems to me, in a very strange posture, because the way both sides have teed this up on the second part, the termination-related part, not the anniversary of execution part, on the termination part, is as if it's a referendum on Frito-Lay. In other words, that there are two ways that this could be resolved. One is to say, per your view, that once the contract expires, then from that point forward, revocability kicks in. The other way is to say, no, even if there's a pre-termination window, that's still enough. That was the issue in Frito-Lay, and the board said, well, the pre-termination window was still enough, and we could have an argument about whether that's consistent with 302C4. And your view would be that it's not, because it has to be post-termination. What I don't understand about this case, though, is it just doesn't even seem to present that issue. And the reason it seems not to present that issue is that what the ALJ said and what the board affirmed is that this is a case in which the only people who got the benefit of the second part, the termination part, are the people who signed within the last year of the CBA. Nobody else got a benefit at all. So there was no, as far as I can tell, the ALJ decided the case on the assumption that there was no pre-termination window. There just wasn't. And if there wasn't a pre-termination window and there wasn't anything post-termination either, then we're in a situation in which the second clause, the second part of the statute, oh, the only thing it can mean is that only benefits people who signed their authorization within the last year of the CBA.
Well, I hope I'm following your Honor's point, but the ALJ misread 302 and misread Atlanta Printing Specialties badly.
I don't think I'm asking about what the ALJ, and I understand this is a little bit confusing, but I don't think I'm asking about the way the ALJ understood the law. I'm asking about the factual predicate of this case. It seems to me that this case has come to us on the assumption that what happened was the employees had an opportunity to revoke in a pre-expiration window, that you take the 30 to 45-day window and you apply it not only to the anniversary of the execution of the authorizations, but you also apply it to the contract termination, and that they had an opportunity to revoke 30 to 45 days before the contract revocation. And then the question for us is that okay? That's what the board would say, because Frito-Lay says it's okay. You would say it's not okay, because a pre-termination window isn't enough. You have to have revocability post-termination. My point is that this case just doesn't present that, because there was no pre-termination window per the ALJ's description of the agreement.
Well, I'm not sure why Your Honor says this case doesn't present that. There were my clients, the seven petitioners, and hundreds of people who sent in revocation letters from the date the contract terminated in October 2008 until the day a successor agreement was put into place in November 2009.
I think we're talking past each other, but I think this is actually a factual point that I think is in your favor, which is this.
Yeah,
that,
I'm totally confused at this point.
Which is
well,
this.
Well,
that,
well
okay.
I think
listen carefully to
it's a confusing point, but let me try to be as clear as possible, and just bear with me for a minute. Frito-Lay presents the following situation. It says, per the second part of the statute, which deals with the escape opportunity that's tied to termination. I'm not worried about anniversary of execution. I'm just talking about the termination-related part. What Frito-Lay says is, there's two ways one could look at that. One could say that vis-a-vis termination, a pre-termination window is enough. That's what happened in Frito-Lay, and the board says that's okay. Or your view would be, no, a pre-termination window isn't enough. Under 302C4, under the plain text, because it says beyond, revocability has to be post-termination. It's not enough just to give a pre-termination window.
So
far you're with me. So that's the way the case comes to us. My point is this, that in this case, there wasn't even a pre-termination window, because the way the ALJ clearly, under the ALJ's opinion, the way the ALJ described the case is that the only people who got the benefit of a termination-related escape were the people who signed in the last year of the CBA. That's how the ALJ read the authorization. That's how the ALJ read the statute. So in other words, the employees never had a pre-termination window because the authorization didn't provide for one.
And that may be very true. And I think if I win on that ground, that there never even was that pre-termination in that
case. Why should you win on that ground when you didn't raise it?
I raised that what we...
Did you raise the point? If you raised it, it sure went by me. Did you raise it?
That there was no, not even a pre-termination opportunity in this case?
Did you raise that?
I did not specifically brief
that.
You did say that
the letters never advised your employees of any pre-termination window.
Yes, that's correct. I mean, we believe that the union interpreted its own checkoff to not provide this opportunity.
Do you dispute that the ALJ decided the case? As I read the ALJ's opinion, it's absolutely clear. The ALJ says on a number of occasions that the opportunities that should have been provided under the agreement were the annual, the first part, the annual re-up on the execution date. But as to termination, the only opportunity that needed to have been provided was to those who signed in the very last year of the CBA.
I think that's how, among the errors of the ALJ's opinion, I think that is one of them.
Okay.
And yes, we have argued that the union did not properly provide even that window period. We talk about their letters.
Did you say that, counsel? Really?
It wasn't a central, I will say.
Did you say it?
We point out the errors. I don't think that we argued that as the central point. And I will say that. That's correct.
Because we're talking, this is an administrative law case, and we're trying to understand the agencies. We have to decide whether to affirm or set aside what the agency did. And it seems to me that the case is presented to us on a factual posture, that just isn't what the agency, in fact, confronted. What the agency confronted is one in which there was no pre-termination window afforded. There just wasn't.
Well, then there was a violation of Section 302, and that's been our argument all along. That's the argument that we raised.
That's not the big issue. That's not the Frito-Lay issue. In other words, what Judge Srinivasan said, it looked like the facts in this case avoid the Frito-Lay issue.
I don't see how that's possible. I mean, my clients and some 700...
You can win the case, according to Judge Srinivasan, without our deciding the Frito-Lay issue.
Well, Your Honor, I'll be happy to win the case on any grounds that the court would like to give it to me.
Apart from the question of whether you specifically raised this way of looking at the case, you obviously raised the point that you should win under 302C4. At that level of generality, you raised the question. So if we're talking about possible ways in which you might win under 302C4, and obviously I'm not saying you definitely would, but possible ways in which you might, do you disagree with me on the factual predicate? As I read the ALJ's opinion, the ALJ decides the case on the assumption that there was no pre-termination window for people outside the first year. I just don't see any other way to read the opinion. I can read you the quotes from the JA, but I just don't see how else you read it. And I'll just direct your attention to, for example, JA 309. And I'm looking at the first full paragraph. It starts with applying the checkoff authorization. The first sentence is about the yearly anniversary date. In addition, employees who signed authorizations during the last year of the contract could revoke their authorizations upon the expiration of that contract. That's the only time that the ALJ hypothesizes there's any opportunity to revoke vis-a-vis termination. He says the same thing again at least two other times. So the case just comes to us on the assumption that there was no pre-termination window.
Your Honor, I don't understand
why the board would have concluded as it did. It doesn't make any sense. If there is no pre-termination window at all, how can it be consistent with the board's position in Frito-Lay?
Well, Your Honor, I view this whole case as a giant administrative screw-up, if you will. I mean, to my way of thinking, The ULP charges were clear. The complaint that the general counsel issued was clear. The way I like to look at this case is the seizure of dues from employees is per se a violation unless the union can show that it has a valid and binding agreement with them. And here, however you look at it, there was not a valid and binding agreement because the employees revoked beyond the termination date of the applicable collective bargaining agreement. That's the argument that we made, and the argument that Section 302 is not even a statute within the
ambit of the board. Well, you don't even have what Judge Srinivasan says. You win easily because there's not even a pre-termination window, which is what the board... I don't understand the board's opinion.
Which actually gets me to it.
I don't understand why the board is relying on Frito-Lay if there's no pre-termination window at all.
Your Honor, you'll have to ask the board that. My clients are grocery workers. Many of them are teenagers. If you look in the joint appendix at the kind of letters that these people wrote, they made it clear, they were very inartful, many of them, but they made it clear one way or another they wanted to disassociate from the union. They used all kinds of different terminology, but the fact of the matter is every one of those people was exercising their Section 7 rights to refrain, and the answer from the union and the answer from the board was no, you can't do it. And however the ALJ misconstrued the law, which we certainly believe, and we've argued that he completely misconstrued Atlanta Printing Specialties and Anheuser-Busch, which are authoritative on this point and on 302, a statute over which the board
I thought you had a very good argument on the word beyond rather than at. But I'm sort of, and it seems to me if there's no, not even a window period, I don't understand what the contention of the, well, we'll have to wait and hear what the board says.
I think the board, we'll ask the board, I think the board leaves that issue open in a footnote in its brief, but.
Which issue?
On the question of whether, even in the absence of a pre-termination window, it's still consistent with 302C4. But we can ask the board that, obviously, okay. That's not yours.
I would like to also discuss the inconsistency of the board's own precedent when you compare what happened here and in Frito-Lay with KYCTV and Lincoln Lutheran, two recent board decisions. It shows the complete inconsistency and possibly incoherence of the way the board looks at these kinds of cases and 302C4. Because in Lincoln Lutheran and KYCTV, the board overruled Bethlehem Steel, 50 years of law, and says we are no longer going to allow employers to determine when checkoffs should be revoked because that is the exclusive and unfettered right of the employees under 302C4 to revoke beyond the termination of the contract.
So well, if that's your view, can I ask you a question? Well, let's suppose the question is before us, the issue is, as it's been teed up, the Frito-Lay issue, just for argument's purposes. One thing I don't understand about your argument is this, that it seems to me that your argument could be, but is not, that if beyond means what you think it means, that once the agreement expires, there's revocation on the table, period. It doesn't matter if there's a new CBA. But yet, as I read your briefs, I think it's clear from your briefs, you think that once a new CBA is signed, that new CBA becomes the applicable agreement, and then irrevocability kicks back in.
I think that's correct. I think that's the most reasonable way to read Section 302.
The employees would need a new authorization. That's, I think Judge Srinivasan is getting to that point almost inevitably. Is that your point, sir?
That's where I'm going. And I guess one way to look at it is why would you then draw a distinction between a subsequent CBA and the extension agreements? Because they're all new contracts. So it seems to me that your position is a little bit of a hybrid position because you're saying you're not willing to say once the first agreement expires, infinite irrevocability, because you allow for the notion that when a new CBA kicks in, irrevocability kicks back in. But then It seems to me the extension of that would be, well, that also applies to the extension agreements.
Well, I would be happy to say that the checkoffs are automatic.
But you're not.
But okay.
You're
but,
not saying, but, because you said exactly otherwise in the brief.
I haven't argued that in the brief. That's correct.
In fact, but it's not just that you haven't argued it. It seems to me you've argued the exact opposite, because you've said that the...
Although all parties seem to agree that the interim agreements don't qualify as applicable agreements.
Right.
Both sides agree on that.
And that's where I was going to next, because however you look at this, these temporary agreements are not applicable agreements. The judge didn't treat them as such,
And I don't understand the difference. How is it? Just explain to me legally, how is it that a new CBA is an applicable agreement, but an extension of the CBA, which is a new contract, is not an applicable agreement?
Well, if you look at the actual extension agreements, they actually talk about retroactivity, that if we reach new terms that provide for higher wages, then it will be retroactive. I mean, it's clear that those extension agreements are not meant to be full collective bargaining agreements. It really is just a way to mark a period in which the company and the union are going to continue to negotiate. And so that's all it is. There won't be any strikes during that period. It's kind of like a
standstill. It's like a standstill agreement.
Exactly. They just call the time out. And
are those well enough known in the? This is just as a matter of fact. Are they well enough known in the industry that the board as an administrative body or a court that's on judicial review can easily draw a distinction between what is a applicable agreement that comes along and what is not an applicable agreement that comes along?
I think if you go to Labor Law 101, yes, the answer is yes, there's a distinction. And I'll tell you one clear distinction. Under the board's contract bar doctrine, which means when can employees file for decertification, they cannot file for decertification while a contract exists for up to 3 years. But they could have filed for decertification during all of these extension agreements.
Another union could file an election petition.
Right. Well, same idea. But the point is, the board has never said that these temporary extension agreements constitute a real collective bargaining agreement.
I guess these most recent questions get to the point that I was trying to, I guess, fish out with my initial question, which is that my understanding of the definition of the term irrevocable means, I mean, if you look at Black's Law Dictionary, Oxford, Webster's, that it's unalterable, you know, committed beyond recall, cannot be undone, et cetera, et cetera. And what seems to happen here is that in that first year, it is truly irrevocable in the sense that there's nothing that you can do to get out of the checkoff. It's unalterable. It can't be undone.
That's actually not true as a matter of law. If a union becomes defunct, the revocation is automatic, as the board will agree. There are exceptions.
But that's what 302C4 seems to be driving at. Those periods after the 1 year, those seem to be restrictions on your ability to revoke. But that's not the same as saying that all of a sudden it's become completely irrevocable again. And so that's why I'm not following your argument in general, because it seems that you're trying to not really follow the plain language of what irrevocable means.
Your Honor, I would say a few things to that. I'm following what Atlanta Printing Specialties and Anheuser-Busch, the Fourth and the Fifth Circuits, said about this very language. I don't see ambiguity here. There are two separate periods in which employees have rights. The first one can be made irrevocable for a period of up to 1 year. Congress wanted people to have the opportunity at least once a year to change their mind. That's the first portion. The second distinct period occurs when a contract expires, when a contract terminates, to use the language of the statute, because Congress wanted employees to be able to have a fresh look then. As Atlanta Printing Specialties said, to determine for themselves, now that the old contract has
come. I understand that. Maybe I'm not being clear. Just because something is no longer irrevocable doesn't mean that you can't place limits on revocation.
Well, that's number one, that's not what the statute says. The statute
I'm just asking as a matter of English language, right? Just because something is no longer irrevocable doesn't mean that it's completely revocable at will once the period of irrevocability ends.
Well, Your Honor, I could only say that I don't find ambiguity here, and when the statute is designed to protect employees' rights of free choice, and it says shall not be irrevocable beyond the termination, I don't find ambiguity here. And I would like
So if the statute, if somebody says, well, your revocation has to be in writing after that period of irrevocability, you can't say that because that's some sort of a limitation.
Well, it could be, Your Honor. If you look at the Supreme Court's Felter case, in Felter, the union said you can only revoke if you use our special form. And the Supreme Court struck that down and said, no, this is about employee free choice, and we're not going to allow you to create all kinds of sort of Mickey Mouse restrictions to make it more difficult for employees, as the Supreme Court
said.
Okay,
but that's not my hypothetical. My hypothetical is you can't be oral, it has to be in writing.
Well, let's look
at that. Does that violate the plain language of the statute?
I'm not sure I would say that violates the plain language, but I would also say that has to be looked at in terms of what the checkoff agreement says. This checkoff agreement says in writing, we haven't challenged that. That's not an issue. So, I mean, in a sense, you could call that a limitation, but the basic concept of being able to revoke is an employee free choice right. As I said at the outset, Your Honor, Section 7 and 8 work in tandem with Section 302C4. And I want to add one point to this, which Judge Silberman's answer before reminded me. None of this is ironclad, even about irrevocability. And I'll give you an example. If you look at the Penn Cork case out of the Seventh Circuit, employees had signed checkoffs that said, this is irrevocable for a year. But during that year, they deauthorized the union security clause, meaning they took out of the contract any obligation to pay, and the board and the Second Circuit then said, even though they signed an irrevocable checkoff clause, the subsequent event of having a deauthorization election and taking forced dues out of the contract opened it up as a matter of Section 7 and 8 law that everybody should now have a new opportunity. So, again, irrevocability is looked at in terms of employee free choice. And that's been our position throughout.
What is your position, though, as far as, like, we've held in the Associated Press v. an NLRB case back in the 70s, that Section 302, a violation of that, does not necessarily constitute an unfair labor practice under Section 7.
I would say, first of all, that it's hard to imagine a violation of Section 302C4 in this context that isn't a violation of Section 7 and 8. And secondly, with regard to the Associated Press case, this court did not in any way opine on what Section 302 actually meant. It was a deferral to arbitration case. This court said, we don't mean to opine on 302 any more than the board did. And in the Fourth Circuit in Anheuser-Busch was looking at Associated Press. It said the D.C. Circuit did not opine on Section 302. It was simply a deferral to arbitration case that I believe has no impact on what's going on here today.
Let me go back to Judge Srinivasan's hypothetical or discussion of the facts in this case. Assuming his question, which is simply a fact question, is correct, what is in front of us then?
All I can say is what is in front of you is the complaint that the general counsel issued, which said that employees tried to revoke and their revocations were denied. What then comes up before you is the ALJ said that was perfectly fine for them to deny these revocations. The board affirmed. So we are here now saying whatever the ALJ did and the board affirmed, it is a violation of Section 7 and 8 and 302C4 that work together in tandem to protect employees' free choice.
And if Judge Srinivasan is correct, your view is it is unnecessary for us to encounter Frito-Lay to conclude that the board violated Section 7 and Section 8.
If the court wants to avoid
No. If Judge Srinivasan is correct, do we have to avoid Frito-Lay? I mean, we can only decide what the board did.
Your Honor, I wish I could actually understand what the board did in this case, because all we have before us is what I consider to be a very unwell ALJ opinion, rubber-stamped by a board.
As you well know, and I know, many cases, board cases, are just ALJ opinions affirmed cursorily by the board. So we're looking at the ALJ's opinion as the board opinion. And I'm sort of mystified because you haven't really made the argument that Judge Srinivasan shrewdly observed. So I'm puzzled what is our appropriate appellate review at this point.
I think the appropriate appellate review is for the court to say that the board did not properly enforce Section 7 and 8 and Section 302 in the way that it held that these hundreds and hundreds of revocations were not valid and these people had to continue paying dues.
It seems to me in a lot of situations like this, there's at least the in an agency situation, there's the opportunity, if we don't know what the predicate is, then there's the opportunity to send it back to the agency for clarity. Which would be a disposition that would be in your favor because it would send it back to the agency.
Well, I would ask that. I mean, I obviously the court will do what the court will, but I would ask that not happen for several reasons. Number one, a lot of this case involves 302C4, which the board has no authority over. The board is entitled to no deference over, et cetera. That's the first thing. The second thing is, this case has been around for a very long time. It lived through Noel Canning, and it's here for the second time.
Well, no matter what, any resolution in your favor would require sending it back to the agency, period, matter what. So, I mean, I don't think I'm saying anything that is not in accordance with what everybody agrees would have to happen.
But sending it back for the board to reassess the entire decision versus sending it back for compliance.
I don't mean to be drawing that distinction. Yeah. I do have one question for you. I know we're over, but on the, let's assume that we actually have the Frito-Lay issue before us. Hypothetically, let's assume that it's before us. If we look at the text of 302C4, why isn't it right that even if there's a pre-termination window, that it still satisfies the second clause? Because at that point, it is still true that it's not irrevocable beyond the termination date because there's an opportunity to revoke that would be effective beyond the termination date.
I think that's not in keeping with the statute for the reasons that Anheuser-Busch and Atlanta Printing Specialties said much better than I can, which is that an employee gets to the point when his contract expires. He doesn't know what the new contract is going to be. He has no idea what's going to happen in this hiatus. Telling an employee that he has a pre-termination revocation window is not consistent with that piece of employee free choice that says you don't yet know what is going to happen. You're forcing and
the way you read the statute, the exact same thing would be true if a new CBA were entered into whose date was coterminous with the expiration of the first CBA. That employee still would also have never know what's going to be in the new CBA, but also would have no entitlement vis-a-vis termination.
I think that's a quirk of the statute.
But it's true. It's factually true that that employee would have no ability to exercise any revocation vis-a-vis termination.
Well, there wouldn't be, because there would be no actual termination. I mean, that's it is a quirk of the second part of it. So,
your response, perhaps, to Judge Srinivasan might be, if I understood his first hypothetical correctly, it would be satisfactory to have a revocation period for 30 days after signing.
I think that
if Judge Srinivasan's hypothetical were correct, then that would work too. And your view is that would clearly be inconsistent with the purpose of the statute.
I think that's correct. I would conclude by saying all of this is about employee free choice. And what we have in this case, boiled down, is a trickle of employees became a flood. Hundreds and hundreds of people are trying to exercise their Section 7 rights and head for the exits. And the union kept them from doing that for the obvious pecuniary reason that having more money is better than having less money. And thank you, Your Honors.
Thanks.
Good morning, Your Honor. David Seid for the Labor Board. I'd like to start out by taking a step back and reminding the court on the two uncontested grounds that led the board to dismiss the complaint. First, the board found that the authorization dues deduction signed by the employees was facially valid. Second, the board found that no charging party tried to revoke the authorization during any of the possible window periods, which the parties conceded included a window period, and this is at page 312 of the appendix. The parties conceded including a window based on the anniversary date of signing and a window period at the
Fact that the parties conceded it before the ALJ decided it doesn't mean that much, I don't think, because all you're talking about arguments made before the ALJ, right? So the parties make arguments before the ALJ, and I grant you that in those arguments before the ALJ, both sides seems to suppose that there was a pre-termination window. Now, if you look at the authorization, I don't see it in the authorization, but we can put that to one side. Both parties seem to suppose that. But the ALJ, after that, issues an opinion. And in the ALJ's opinion, it just doesn't talk about a pre-termination window. In fact, it says that there wasn't one because the only possibility of revocation vis-a-vis termination is for those in the last year. Do you read the ALJ opinion differently?
Your Honor, it is very possible to read the administrative law judge's decision in that manner.
Is it possible to read it differently?
No, it's a reasonable interpretation.
Is it possible to read it differently?
No. But the board, no? Okay. Your Honor, but the important aspect here is what did the board do? And it is correct. The board didn't specifically clarify that. Now, the board doesn't
know. The board just affirmed the ALJ's opinion, right?
But the board affirmed, but again, with the recognition.
Did the board say anything? I can't remember.
Yes, Your Honor. In appendix page 307 in footnote 2, the board said there is no evidence that any of the charging parties tried to revoke or even inquired about revoking their authorization during any of the possible window periods.
Right, but we don't know what window. We don't know whether that means anniversary date or termination. I mean, if where you're going is saying that by saying any possible window periods, we should infer that that means the board assumed that there was a pre-termination window, that seems to be fairly heroic because it doesn't say anything about termination. It just has possible window periods, which could be the same possible window periods the ALJ had in mind, which are the anniversary dates. And, for anybody in the last year, but I don't think any of the petitioners are are somebody who signed during the last year. Is that where you were going with that footnote? I did not mean to step. But is there any other indication besides that footnote that the board operated on the assumption contrary, operated on an assumption contrary to the ALJ's, which seemed to be that there was no pre-termination window.
Your Honor, it would be in that footnote, and whether the board could have been clearer in that footnote.
No, can we assume there was or was not a pre-termination window before? What's the answer to that?
As counsel, I would represent that the board is recognizing that there was, for the purposes of the employees here, they had a second window, and no employee tried to take advantage of that
second window. Where was it?
Prior, Your Honor, as the parties recognized before the administrative law judge, a window prior to the expiration.
What was it? Because was there anything besides the arguments of the parties before the ALJ, is there anything, any letter, anything in the record that shows that anybody understood there was a pre-termination window?
No, Your Honor, that was the argument that the general counsel tried to make below, that there wasn't really a second window, that there was confusion based on the letters. And the judge does recognize that there was a second window. He goes on to basically say it doesn't apply to everyone, but he does recognize that there was a second window.
Where? He doesn't say there was a second window. Meaning a pre-termination window?
Your Honor, I mean, in at page 312 of the appendix, where at the trial, when discussing the window period prior to the expiration of the contract, the general counsel conceded that both parties agree that during the 15-day window period before October 2008, that the parties could revoke.
But he doesn't accept that characterization. He's just talking about the general counsel's characterization, and then every time he describes it, he's saying that's beside the point. Because as I read this, I'm just trying to read this honestly, as I read this, what the ALJ is saying is, I know there's some supposition in the arguments that there was a pre-termination window, but as I, being the ALJ, as I read the authorization, there is no pre-termination window. The window has to do with the annual anniversary vis-a-vis execution. It doesn't have to do with termination. So there just wasn't one, and that's how he describes it every time he talks about it.
And I understand that is what the administrative law judge did, and whether the board...
So then if the administrative law judge doesn't find a pre-termination window, how the devil can he rely on Frito-Lay?
Right, because in Frito-Lay there was a pre-termination window, and that was the whole issue in Frito-Lay.
You understand my question. I'm mystified here.
I understand the question, Your Honor, because the administrative law judge does say Frito-Lay as foreclosing certain arguments.
When I read the opinion, I assumed there was a pre-termination window. Everybody litigating assumes it. The ALJ assumes it, but then says something confusing. So is there or is there not a pre-termination window? You're representing the board.
As counsel for the board, that the parties understood there was a pre-termination window, and no party tried to take advantage of it, and the board recognizes that basically whatever the window periods are, and the board does acknowledge that in earlier cases, like Atlanta Printing, it does suggest that there is a window period at both the anniversary and at the expiration of the contract. There's no indication that that wouldn't apply to everyone as opposed to people that just signed in the last year. Could the board have further clarified that here?
Are we to assume there was a pre-termination window prior to the expiration of the collective bargaining agreement in this case in the Court of Appeals?
Yes, Your Honor, and from the board's perspective, the parties understood that, and no party tried to advantage
it. How can we assume that if the ALJ just flat out said there wasn't, and that's what the board affirmed? There's just, I don't understand, it's like creating a case, creating a hypothetical case that doesn't exist, because whether the ALJ was right or wrong, we can argue about whether the ALJ was right or wrong about this, because I understand that the parties took the position before the ALJ that there was a pre-termination window, as to which, by the way, there's absolutely no record as far as I can tell. But whether or not the ALJ was right or wrong, it seems pretty crystal clear from the ALJ's decision that the ALJ concluded that there was no pre-termination window. Still applied Frito-Lay, which raises an issue, obviously. But that's the background against which this case comes to us. So we'd be deciding, it seems to me, a hypothetical case, because the decision affirmed by the board is one that said there's no pre-termination window, and then yet we'd be deciding a case on the assumption that there was a pre-termination window, which just seems to me what courts are not supposed to be doing.
Your Honor, I would remind the court that this is a dismissal of a complaint, and Whether the board could have been clearer in its footnote is debatable and arguable, but by stating that no employee tried to revoke during any of the possible window periods, and given the earlier recognition of the parties, the board is not specifically clarifying whether there always has to be
two weeks. You think the board's footnote modifies the ALJ opinion, which sometimes happens when the board, is that what you're saying? The board has concluded there were window periods, so that's before us rather than the ALJ's opinion?
Your Honor, honestly, the board didn't use the word modify,
the board doesn't often do that. I'm quite familiar. Sometimes a footnote of the board de facto modifies the ALJ's opinion without stating we're modifying. Is that your position here?
Your Honor, the board's position is simply that the parties recognize there are two windows. Nobody tried to escape during those two windows, and the board
It may be that nobody tried to escape because it didn't exist, or at least there was no indication to anybody that existed. Even if the parties took that position, there's just no record anywhere of any knowledge.
Isn't this a powerful argument for remand? Because the board's because the issue before us is so utterly confused.
No, Your Honor, because the party...
We should affirm the board on this case?
You can affirm a dismissal based on the principle that the
petitioners lose for some reason, we don't know why.
There are arguments made below that either a window period didn't exist or that basically that the union had tried to mislead the employees.
Well, didn't exist, there is no question, even under board law, even under a pro Frito-Lay law, it would be a violation of the Act, right?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Let me say again.
Sure.
If there was no window period, the union did not provide a window period prior to the expiration of the contract, and at the expiration of the contract, the employees sought to revoke, it would clearly be an unfair labor practice for the union and the employer not to allow them to revoke.
Your Honor, arguably, certainly for the ones that signed in the last year of the contract, and arguably under the board's Atlanta printing decision, that everyone should have that opportunity.
Is that what you think?
My answer to my question is yes. Is that not right?
Yes, for the most part, yes.
Okay.
Then we just take Judge Srinivasan's point. How the devil do we decide that we can't affirm the board then? How can we possibly affirm the board in that situation?
Because
I don't envy your guy. Many, many, many years ago, I was in your position arguing cases for the board. I've never seen one as strange as this.
Your Honor, I would simply, again, whether this court might deem that the board's footnote.
So let me ask you this. Let me put it to you this way. Suppose the footnote didn't exist. I'll get to the footnote because I have a question about the footnote. But let's suppose the footnote language didn't exist at all, and everybody agrees. Let's suppose everybody agrees that the ALJ decided this case on the assumption that there was no pre-termination window, and in fact found that there was no pre-termination window. The board affirms. It comes to us briefed as it is. What would you have us do?
Well, Your Honor, what the judge found was that under that 302C4 in his interpretation didn't require a pre-termination window. And whether that would be a proper interpretation of 302C4 as applied to the Act, and whether that would be a clear error and the board hadn't stated its footnote, then of course that would be an issue. And I think as Earl indicated earlier, it's not entirely clear that petitioners have really quite even made this.
But let's just assume away. Put aside whether they raised it properly or not. I'm just asking, what would the board have us do in that situation? It would be hard. I think the board would be hard pressed to say we should affirm, which makes it seem like what the board would say is we should send it back. But I just want a clear answer.
Well, yeah, Your Honor, there would certainly be an issue whether if the board didn't say anything, then the ALJ's decision as it stands, whether the ALJ misinterpreted the rights that employees have under Section 302C4 as it relates to Section 8 of the Act.
Which means that what? Then what would the board have us do?
Well, the argument that the petitioners would be making to the board, to this court, is whether or not the board's interpretation, as set forth by ALJ, was a reasonable interpretation.
And under your, as I understand it, the board's own view of Atlantic Printing is that there has to be some window associated with termination. The board takes the view that a pre-termination window is enough. That's Frito-Lay. Your opposing counsel takes the view that no pre-termination window is not enough. But if there was no pre-termination window here either, then under the board's view, under Atlantic Printing, as I understand it, then the board wouldn't be able to take the position that we should affirm the ALJ because the ALJ thought there was no pre-termination window.
Your Honor, the board's position would be that regardless of how the ALJ may or may not have interpreted 302C4, on the facts of this particular case, the parties ultimately before this court are not disputing that everyone had the opportunity to revoke at the termination of the contract.
But we have
at the termination of the contract?
Well, at the window period.
Oh, you didn't mean
the window
period.
Yes, no, excuse me, at the window period.
But that just doesn't, then you're constructing a hypothetical case. I mean, so the ALJ just didn't decide that. It just didn't. So whether you and the other side could agree on that till the cows come home, but then all you're doing is setting up a hypothetical case that we don't actually have before us if my assumption about the ALJ's opinion is right. Would you agree with that characterization?
Your Honor, I would simply argue that whether or not the ALJ correctly interpreted 302C4 is not the ultimate issue. The ultimate issue is on the facts of this case, whether the board reasonably dismissed it.
If there was no re-termination window, why did the ALJ conclude there was no violation? If there was no pre-termination window under board law, the employees should have been entitled to revoke at the end of the contract. Isn't it? That's clear. So why the devil does the ALJ conclude there's not a violation if there was no pre-termination window?
Your Honor, because the administrative law judge then recognizes Frito-Lay, and there are discrepancies in the ALJ's decision.
Can't you answer the point here? I'm really honestly confused. How could the ALJ conclude this was not a violation if he concludes there's no pre-termination window? Because even under Frito-Lay, there had to be a pre-termination window allowing a revocation.
Your Honor, because, again, notwithstanding the judge's interpretation of 302C4, at the same time, he also did specifically recognize the party's understanding that there were window periods.
No, I don't think so. I think what the ALJ did, sorry, can I just finish this one point? I think what the ALJ did is the ALJ overread Frito-Lay. The ALJ thought that Frito-Lay stood for the proposition that even absent a pre-termination window, it's still okay. Because here's why. Because the ALJ thought the termination part of 302C4 still does work for those people who signed the CBA, or who signed the authorization in the last year of the CBA. That's the work the ALJ thought was being done by that last clause. And as I read the ALJ's opinion, it's pretty crystal clear that what the ALJ is saying is, Frito-Lay tells me that there doesn't have to be post-termination revocation. I know there's a revocation opportunity vis-a-vis termination for those people in the last year. Therefore, Frito-Lay tells me that this is okay, even though there's no pre-termination window for people who signed outside the last year.
Your Honor, as I understood the administrative law judge's decision, the reference to Frito-Lay was simply trying to, and if I could take a step back again for a minute, the general counsel had conceded and never disputed that the legitimacy or the application of Frito-Lay, that there were window periods. Even the general counsel's argument.
Well, that's totally confusing, too. The general counsel's position is incomprehensible. I don't understand. He basically challenges Frito-Lay and says, I'm not challenging Frito-Lay. But that gets to the substantive issue, which we don't reach, I assume, if there is no pre-termination window. But I think we're beating a dead horse.
Can you look at the language at page 311 of the appendix? The left column, about midway down, there's a paragraph that begins, it says, I first take time to individually address.
Yes.
And if you go to the third sentence there, it says, the letters, in fact, did not provide information of the dates on which the employees could next revoke their authorizations upon the expiration of the contract. Then the ALJ says, but remember, no new contract had been reached, so there were no dates to provide. What does that mean?
Your Honor, that, as I understand, is a reference that after the contract had expired, for employees who tried to revoke their dues and they were untimely based on their anniversary date, at that point there was no existing contract in effect, so there was no basis or reason for the letters to set forth a window period based on contract expiration. And that's an argument that the petitioners have not raised any of the factual arguments that the administrative law judge, as upheld by the board, rejected.
But doesn't that acknowledge that there is a pre-termination window based on the language in the checkoff authorization, or else why would the ALJ have put this sentence in the opinion?
Your Honor, again, I would suggest that given the party's recognition on 312, on appendix page 312, that there were window periods, given the arguments raised by the general counsel, in which the general counsel acknowledged in the briefs to the administrative law judge that there were window periods, given some of the language here regarding that the letters were defective because it didn't contain a window period relating to the termination of a contract since there was no contract in effect, that notwithstanding the judge's interpretation of 302C4 and whether that's correct
or not. Read the next sentence, because the next sentence says, and unless the new collective bargaining agreement was to be for a term less than a year, then the anniversary dates described in the letters were indeed the next chance the employees could revoke their authorization. In other words, what the ALJ is saying is, yeah, there's an opportunity vis-a-vis termination for people in the last year. For anybody outside the last year, there's nothing for vis-a-vis termination.
Correct, Your Honor. And there's no question that the judge is suggesting that. And the board, okay. And again, whether the board could have or should have clarified that based on its, say, Atlanta printing decision, but the bottom line is, given all of the parties' recognition at the hearing, in the briefs to the judge, in the briefs to the board, that there were window periods, and that the particular facts are no longer being disputed, that the union had somehow misled the employees, that's not being disputed anymore, certainly not before this court. The board is simply recognizing that no one tried to revoke during any of the potential window periods. And any of the potential window periods is referring to any of the window periods. Window periods.
But that's exactly the language one would use. I've written a million briefs that use this kind of language. That's exactly the language one would use if one were not answering the question of whether there was a pre-termination window. Because what you'd be saying is, any termination, any window, whatever they may be, was not one in which the employees exercised their option. That's exactly what you would say. So it's hard to read that language to countermand the factual predicate against which the ALJ decided the case.
I understand the court's concern. At the end of the day, obviously the board's footnote stands on its own, and I can only state that given the recognition, particularly by the general counsel, all the way through that there were two window periods, and that the fact that what is dropped by the wayside at this point to this court is whether the union misled employees regarding those window periods. That was really the general counsel's theory below. And that's something that the petitioners are certainly not arguing to this court.
Okay.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court, Kristen Martin, Davis Carolinbo, representing the intervenor union. I'm going to try to address the issue that you've been discussing with counsel and maybe clear things up. The window period that all the parties believe preceded the termination date of the contract was in September of 2008. The ULP charges in this case were filed in December of 2009. Under Section 10B of the Act, there's a 6-month statute of limitation. So even if the union disregarded a window period in September of 2008, it was outside of the statute of limitations. It's simply not an issue in this case.
Wait a minute. You're raising a new issue in this case now?
I'm responding to the issue that was raised by the court. I'm explaining why this apparent mistake, and I would agree this is a mistake in the ALJ's opinion by saying there's no, both a mistake of law and a mistake of fact, that there's no pre-termination window.
Is this a mistake of fact?
It is a mistake of fact.
There was such a thing as a pre-termination
yes,
window?
Yes, and I would point
where, how do we find it?
To Joint Appendix 135, there's testimony from a representative of the union, and he's being asked what the union's position is, how the union has interpreted the authorization card, because one of the general counsel's theories was the authorization card was confusing. So this witness is being asked how the union interpreted this card.
What and page?
305 of the joint appendix. And if I would direct the court to starting on line 7, Mr. Zappala, that's the counsel for the union asking questions, he said, did you give direction about how to implement the dues checkoff to your staff? Answer, yes. Question, what direction did you give? Answer, that a window period 30 to 45 days prior to the anniversary of date of signing it and prior to the expiration of the contract. So that was the union's, that was the evidence.
There were two of them, prior to the anniversary date and prior to the expiration?
Of the contract.
Yes, both.
Yes.
The anniversary date, in the first clause of 302. And the contract is how many days, 30 days prior to?
It's 45 to 30 days prior to the termination of each event. And let me say.
So why does the ALJ say there's no window period?
I don't know why. I think the ALJ just got that wrong.
Well,
that's the only explanation I can provide.
So it could be wrong, but it's also, I thought, it seemed to me that what the ALJ was doing is trying to read the authorization. And when the ALJ read the authorization, the ALJ just didn't think that the window part of the authorization applied to the termination as opposed to the anniversary.
That may have been what the ALJ was doing in mm-hmm. that part of the decision. That may be.
But you wouldn't
disagree. Did he have the actual language?
Yes, the actual language is in evidence many times, and I can point the court to a page on which it appears would be appendix, Joint Appendix 133. There's the authorization card signed by one of the petitioners.
And it explicitly gives a window period 30 to 45 days before the expiration of the collective bargaining agreement?
I will read it to you, Your Honor. The authorization and assignment shall be irrevocable for a period of 1 year from the date of execution or until the termination date of the agreement between the employer and Local 99, whichever occurs sooner, and from year to year thereafter, unless not less than 30 days and not more than 45 days prior to the end of any subsequent yearly period, I give the employer and union written notice of revocation bearing my signature thereto.
Right.
That doesn't refer to the collective bargaining agreement.
It does, Your Honor.
It says it's just the anniversary date.
No, it says, and in the first clause, this authorization assignment shall be irrevocable for a period of 1 year from the date of execution or until the termination date of the agreement between the employer and the union.
Well, it has no, did I miss it? I don't see the window period prior to the termination of the collective bargaining agreement.
Well, it first sets out.
Wait a minute. Was there a window period prior to the termination of the collective bargaining agreement?
Yes, Your Honor.
I didn't hear it.
Okay, let me explain it how this language works again.
I was listening carefully.
And I
heard a window period before the anniversary date. I didn't hear a window period before the expiration of the collective bargaining agreement.
Well, the way the language works, it first sets out the irrevocability period, and then it sets out the window period that applies to each. So it says, and I believe this language is also reproduced in the ALJ's opinion, so one can look
go
at
ahead,
it there as
read
well.
It, read it.
This authorization and assignment shall be irrevocable for a period of 1 year from the date of execution or until the termination date of the agreement between the employer and Local 99, whichever occurs sooner, and from year to year thereafter, unless not less than 30 days and not more than 45 days prior to the end of any subsequent yearly period.
Yeah, that refers to, I've read that too before this case, and certainly doesn't suggest a window period before the termination of the collective bargaining agreement.
One way to ask that question is this, that I read it, and candidly, I read it, and I thought the same thing. When it says subsequent yearly period, maybe there's a way that you could read that to refer to termination, but the most straightforward reading seems to be that it refers to subsequent yearly period vis-a-vis anniversary dates. But what just for comparison purposes, if you look at the language of the authorization in Frito-Lay, the one that the board considered in Frito-Lay, that was crystal clear
yes.
that there was a pre-termination window. This is not even if you, if your position is that you should read it to have a pre-termination window vis-a-vis termination, a pre-termination window, I think you would agree that it's not as clear as or even close to as clear as was the language in Frito-Lay.
Well, I would agree with that, but okay. Let me say this.
Here's the problem. Here's the real problem. Put aside the question of how you interpret it. How did the ALJ interpret it?
And that's, let me say this. The ALJ says, and the board says in the footnote, that no party can, or the general counsel, does not challenge the facial validity of this language. So if this language did provide a pre-termination window, then yes, it would conflict with Section 302C4's proviso. And the ALJ says, look, the general counsel, and we can also find this in the general counsel's briefs directly, he says, I'm not challenging the facial validity of this language.
But that, I don't think that tells us that the ALJ thought there was a pre-termination window, right?
That's right. That doesn't tell us what the ALJ thought about this language, but it does tell us that this language, wasn't before the ALJ.
What we have before us is an agency determination. That agency determination is the ALJ determination, except as it might be modified by the footnote. It doesn't matter for our purposes at this point what your view of the authorization meant. What did the, isn't Judge Srinivasan correct when he says the ALJ stated there was no window period prior to the expiration of the contract?
I don't think that's correct.
What did he say?
What I think matters is what the party...
Wait a minute. Well, in other words, you're not objecting to my statement about, or our Judge Srinivasan's statement about what the ALJ said. You're saying what the ALJ said doesn't matter.
I'm trying to identify the issue that was before the ALJ, and then subsequently before the
No, I'm trying to decide what's the issue before us.
Okay, and then I was going to get to what the issue, because that is a very important issue in this case. And I would argue that none of this is before this court.
Okay, that's a separate set of arguments based on the general counsel's arguments. But no, on this question of the ALJ, the way the ALJ conceived of the case and what that means for us, how, if the ALJ thought there was no pre-termination window, and it seems to me that you agree that the ALJ's opinion assumes away a pre-termination window.
No pre-termination window specified on the card, as opposed to what the parties did in practice. I don't want to make clear about that distinction.
Well, he didn't say anything about what the parties did practice. It may be true that the parties didn't practice what the JA305 says. May be true, but the ALJ, that was somebody's testimony, and the ALJ didn't ratify that.
But then I come back to my first point. Let's assume there was no pre-termination window in this card. And that pre-termination window, when it should have existed, but the ALJ found it didn't, would have come up in September of 2008.
Okay.
That's far outside the statute of limitations that was the events that were even before the ALJ, because the ULP chart wasn't filed until December 2008. So let's assume the argument.
What's the implication of that? So it's outside this.
Here's the implication. Is that what the parties were arguing about, why these charges got filed and why the general counsel brought this case was because we're in a period of successive short-term extensions to the collective bargaining agreement, right? We're in 2009. This contract expired in 2008. The general counsel thought there was a few things that were confusing that took this case out of Frito-Lay, may create, in his mind, an exception to Frito-Lay. And one of those things was he thought the language on the card was ambiguous, but then he went back and said, but I'm not contesting the language on the card. And I think, I can't prove this, but I think that's probably because it was outside of the statute of limitations. It didn't really bear on it. Then he said these letters that were brought up were confusing. And here's what happened with those letters. And I can give the court an example of one, which is at Joint Appendix 135.
Well, the letters aren't going to be that helpful because the letters are all post-expiration.
Well, yeah, exactly.
So they're not going to tell us whether there was a pre-termination window.
But the general counsel's argument was these letters are confusing because they don't set out the pre-termination window, and they didn't set them out because...
I grant you that. But
that's what this case was about. That's the theory the general counsel brought before the ALJ and the board, which was that these things that were occurring in 2009, far beyond the pre-termination window, were causing a lot of confusion, and therefore somehow that operated to make these authorization cards revocable at will.
Would you agree with the following proposition, that if there were no pre-termination window, put aside the statute of limitations question for a second, if there were no pre-termination window, then there's a problem under 302C4?
not necessarily under Section 8, but under problem under Section 302C4. I agree that Section 302C4's proviso requires a pre-termination window.
At least a pre-termination.
Some opportunity to revoke at the termination of the collective bargaining agreement.
And so what we would be in the position of doing, it seems to me, is deciding whether a pre-termination window is enough in a case in which there isn't a pre-termination window. That just seems to me to be an odd place to be as a court, because the ALJ thought there wasn't a pre-termination window, and the way every party has teed this up is decide whether a pre-termination window, which, by the way, wasn't there, is enough.
Well, because the parties are arguing, and again, we argued that this issue, the Frito-Lay issue, isn't even properly before the court, and I want to get to that. But the parties were arguing about whether there was an opportunity to revoke during the hiatus.
Right.
And because the events in this case occurred during the hiatus to the collective bargaining agreement. And the general counsel's theory was that they could these authorizations could be freely revoked during this hiatus period, not because of Frito-Lay, or not inconsistently with Frito-Lay, I should say, but he had another theory, this sort of amorphous confusion theory that was shifting, as the ALJ says, and inconsistent. But it wasn't about because the union didn't give employees an opportunity to revoke back in 2008. That wasn't the theory.
That may well be right.
And so what I would say then is to follow up on, continue on this point, is so the ALJ gets this point wrong about how to interpret something that occurred outside of the statute of limitations. I'm saying it's irrelevant. But even if it is relevant, even if it were within the statute of limitations, then it's just an error in his fact finding, right? Maybe it's a substantial evidence error, but that's all it is.
You're talking about the ALJ?
Yeah, but it doesn't result in change the outcome of the case, I think, in any way. We send it back. We know what the result is because we all agree on what the result is, and it doesn't change the outcome.
No, but we don't have an agency. We don't have an agency determination against the correct factual predicate. I mean, we might want to hypothesize what the agency would do, but we're not supposed to do that. And the positions of counsel before us can't tell us what the agency, in fact, would do. What we have is an agency decision based on a factual predicate that's not the one that informs a legal issue that is being asserted before us.
But it's also irrelevant because it's outside of the statute of limitations, and I come back to that point.
Well, that's a subtle question, the statute of limitations. You can run it from the end of the contract. You can run it from different times.
But
we don't have to get into that, too.
But, Your Honor, it runs from when the charges were filed, and the charges were filed.
Well, wait a minute. Did the board conclude there was anything outside the statute of limitations?
No.
Then that's not before us.
Okay. So then I would turn to the what we see as the primary issue in the case, is what's before this court? Because the sole issue, or the sort of linchpin issue that petitioners have raised, is this Frito-Lay issue. The court has raised now one reason why perhaps that's not properly before the court. But the petitioners certainly haven't raised these flaws with the ALJ's opinion. Secondarily, the Frito-Lay issue wasn't the general counsel's theory.
Yes, but that is a little bizarre, because the general counsel takes a position which de facto challenges Frito-Lay, but doesn't de jure challenge Frito-Lay.
I would describe it differently, Judge Silverman. I think what the general counsel says, and that's why we submitted the supplemental appendix with Judge Silverman's with the general counsel's briefs on the exceptions, is what the general counsel says is, he cites Frito-Lay with approval. He says a union can use a window period prior to contract termination and limit revocation to that window period and provide then for automatic renewal. So he says, Frito-Lay's the law, I'm good with that. And then he goes on to develop this theory based on this sort of confluence of facts that he believed caused confusion, and he's essentially arguing for a fact-specific exception to Frito-Lay. That was the general counsel's theory. And, you know, the employer's counsel argued in opposition to the general counsel, the general counsel must be trying to overrule Frito-Lay. And the general counsel said in his reply brief very clearly, no, I'm not trying to overrule Frito-Lay. I'm not putting that issue before the board. So I would argue that to allow petitioners to raise this Frito-Lay issue in this court, when it wasn't something that was raised before the ALJ by the general counsel, and it wasn't something that was raised or considered by the board, so it wasn't something the board adjudicated, interferes with the general counsel's prosecutorial
discretion. Well, the ALJ relied on Frito-Lay, did he not?
Sure, as a foundational proposition. I mean,
that's the important precedent. So I don't see why that is not before us. If the ALJ's, well, assuming that we properly had the factual predicate, but as Judge Srinivasan keeps pointing out, we may not have the factual predicate.
Well, let me point out.
I don't think we can. My view is we're beating a dead horse.
May I make one final point? Is that the
one final point? Sure.
The general counsel and the board under Section 10B of the Act has discretion to limit what parties who appear before in its administrative proceeding do. And one thing the board makes clear is that parties cannot present different theories than the general counsel presents. They can present evidence, they can call witnesses, they can file briefs, but they can't enlarge upon the general counsel's theory, even if those theories are within the scope of the complaint allegations. And so by allowing either the charging parties to introduce this issue, or by saying merely because an ALJ cites a case, that case is open to being over or reviewed by the Court of Appeals, I think that would open up a lot of law to review that was never within something that the general counsel issued a complaint on or prosecuted. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Mr. Taubman, we'll give you 2 minutes back.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'll try not to beat a dead horse. Just a few points. This last point is the biggest red herring in this case. In their supplemental appendix, they find one inapt quote, where the general counsel says something about, we're not challenging Frito-Lay. But if you look through all of the briefing in this case, if you look at other places in that same supplemental appendix, if you look at the special appeal that the general counsel filed to the board in July 26, 2010, constantly the general counsel is saying, quote, employees' checkoffs became revocable at will after October 25, 2008, and the respondent union's failure to honor those checkoff revocations after this date violated the act. So they're just creating out of whole cloth a red herring here to try to say that this issue cannot be raised by the petitioners when all we've done is mimic what the general counsel has done. Now, back to the merits. The pre-termination window would not have been enough. Even if it was there, it would not have been enough for the general counsel's theory and our theory of this case, because we all argue that there was a right to revoke at will beyond the termination date.
The problem, as Judge Srinivasan keeps pointing out, is if there was no window period preceding the termination of the contract, under board law, this failure to honor the revocation would have been illegal.
Right.
So you're raising a hypothetical case.
I'm happy to win on that basis, but I would just add the last point, and then I would be done, and that is if you look at the bottom of appendix page 310 and the top of page 311, the ALJ says, with regard to the allegations of the complaint about the revocations, he said, these allegations rise or fall on whether or not the employees had to revoke their checkoff authorizations during time periods that are not specified in the authorizations that they had signed. And then he cites Frito-Lay. So in other words, the ALJ was saying, I think, regardless of whether there was a pre-termination or not, the allegations of this complaint, and if you specifically look at the E paragraphs of the complaint, the allegations of this complaint deal with whether there is a right to revoke at will beyond the termination date. That's what the ALJ ruled upon. That's what we've argued all along. So I don't think I can say anything else than that, but I think the issues are presented for the court, and I ask the court to rule in our favor.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you, counsel. The case is submitted.